Our guest now describes foraging for food as the ultimate integration of his outdoor interests. Christchurch-based Peter Langland spends as much time in the fresh air as possible, whether it be bird watching, gathering kai, recreational fishing or photography. He has a degree in zoology and is a licensed professional forager, finding produce for his own consumption as well as supplying restaurants around the country. His love of sourcing food, which is growing wild, includes seaweed, berries, herbs and a multitude of plants not found on supermarket shelves. Peter Langland says safety is a primary concern while gathering wild food. He has a book out called Foraging New Zealand, a guide to more than 250 edible plants and fungi that are okay to eat. Kia ora, Peter. Great to talk.
Yeah, kia ora, Catherine.
It's been a very diverse professional career for you, with a focus on the marine environment for a good bit of it. But sea and fresh water and land. Where did it all start?
Probably just with lots of trips into the high country of my parents, and you know, the Canterbury High Country is a spectacular place. It just left an impression, just the lakes, the lake margins. My parents just loved getting into the outdoors in every weekend, just about. It was religious, really. We went into the high country.
As well as time, as I said, on the commercial fishing boats as an observer, we might return to that later. You're something of an expert on Te Waipounamu's wonderful braided rivers.
Yeah, no, really lucky to have spent over 700 days working on braided rivers and working with the ribald plover, which is actually pretty much endemic as a breeding species to the Canterbury region. So it was a real privilege to work on that tonga, that bird. And it was interesting doing 3 years for DOC and then 3 years for the private sector, but we got some really valuable data on the bird's breeding productivity, which has now actually led into active management, predator control, and it looks like the bird's actually got a relatively stable population, so it's been satisfying.
Fly fishing as well? You've been a guide?
Yeah, no, that was a really exciting time of my life, because no 2 days were the same, and always on new rivers. And my older brother Martin, who's 10 years older, he's worked all his life as a professional guide, so I sort of tagged him with him for a while. And I really enjoyed it. It really allowed me to experience the outdoors through other people's eyes and to meet a lot of people from around the world. It was really quite an amazing time, but I've moved on from that, but it was really rewarding.
So plenty of time spent in and around water, but on land, have you always foraged? Did that go back to childhood?
Oh, sure did, yeah. No, just eating gooseberries or apples. I remember watching wading birds at Lake Ellesmere or Te Waihora when I was about 10. And because I had sharp eyes and I was young, they'd always get me up to the telescope to try and spot birds for them. And I remember just picking up some samphire on the salt marsh flats and munching on it. Forest and bird bus trips in the 1980s were really formative for me as well, eating tree fisher berries. So a lot of really early childhood memories from a lot of time in the outdoors with a really big diversity of people. It really has been an amazing time.
You studied natural sciences at Canterbury University. Has that been part of making sure you know what you're doing? You've built this huge database. Was that an important part of the toolkit?
Oh, for sure. I really value my time at Canterbury University. I got to do master's level papers, fantastic lecturers, a lot of happy memories. And it went full circle. I actually took out a group of first year forestry students into the forest a couple of days ago up in Hamner, looking at foraging in the forest and forest ecology. So it's an exciting feeling that I could give something back to the University of Canterbury. So yeah, a lot of pride. And, you know, I really respect my time at Canterbury University. It gave me a really good grounding in the sciences, taxonomy, accurate species identification, research report writing, all those sort of fundamental skills. My favourite course actually at Canterbury University was a Stage 2 paper, Frameworks for Geographic Inquiry. And that was all about investigative techniques, interviewing techniques, research techniques. It was a really applied paper, and that I really thrived, and I sort of came to life in my second year at university, and that paper was very formative.
So that database of wild forage species, what's on it? 250, I think? That's literally been a lifetime's work.
Yeah, well, the book's got 250 species, but the difficult task was actually reducing it down from about 7,500 species that are on the database.
You've got 7,500 plant species, foraging plant species on your database.
Plants, fungi, and also animals, of course, like shellfish, and of course marine fish as well. So it is pretty all encompassing, but. Whenever I'm searching through social media, I always try to record things just so I've got a record. And yeah, just put them on an Excel database. And a friend of mine helped me with that a few years ago. So that's in development, and that's sort of a somewhere to place information. I also really enjoy using iNaturalist, and that's a really valuable citizen science-based project. There's about 23,000 species recorded in New Zealand, so about a third have sort of edible values.
And you've got 7,500 of them so far. How important is the visual in identification in any database? Just how do you record, either using words or images or anything else, what something is?
I just have photos indexed to a code number for each species, so I can pull up photo albums with the species entry number in the spreadsheet, so it's all sort of cross-referenced, and building up a really big visual database has been good. I love photography, I love the visual side of it all, sort of just being able to document foraging through photography has been really exciting. To be honest, I actually really got into photography and the visual side of documentation when I was fisheries observing, because I realised at that time I'm going to be in some quite unique situations where that will be quite historical, and I won't be able to go back to these places and times. So I got to get a really good visual record on a huge diversity of fisheries around New Zealand. Some of the orange ruffy fisheries when they were being discovered. 6 weeks on a Japanese bluefin tuna longliner, and so I did quite a lot of photo documentary as well when I was on board those boats, that was really exciting, and photojournalism is something that also really interests me as well.
So you've been a professional forager since 2017. How does one become a licensed forager?
That's a good question. Well, I got headhunted by Vaughan Marbe, who's the executive chef at Amersfield, and Vaughan's got a real passion for hyper-local food. He's a real savant in that field. And I gave a presentation at Otago, the culinary school at the Polytech down there. They had an international food design conference in 2016. And I met Vaughan then. And, Vaughan just wanted me to come on board with Amersfield and head out around the Wakatipu Basin every day and just bring things back to the restaurant. That was exciting. We had a really good head chef, Adam Harrison, who is from the UK, and he is really skilled with the preparation and use of foraged foods. With Vaughan, his passion and love of the outdoors. So it was a time things really were thriving, and it's exciting now to see that I think Vaughan's made it into world top 50 chefs. So the foraging really does add a good point of difference with dishes that are served.
How do you get the you've got to have a license to supply restaurants, I understand. Like, what's the kind of the process there?
Yeah, well, we're a bit proactive at Amersfield. We actually set up a system where we were recording things and we advised MPI what we were doing, because we realised that at some point things will get looked at. We have trackability of everything that's foraged. So when I forage things now, I give them a unique code, recording time and location, so there's traceability. And then it's a question of having an audit process done by a licensed food inspector, either through the local council or through MPI, and then just an biannual review process. So it is good. It's good to have a framework like that, because we only want qualified people foraging. It can go really horribly wrong really fast, and sadly we've probably seen an incident like that in the last few days.
This mushroom fatality in Australia, is that what you're referencing?
There's just not much room for error, as we say. Yeah.
Mushrooms seem to be often the one that people are particularly concerned about. So why don't we start with them and the importance of correctly identifying what you're harvesting. What is the issue with the variety of mushrooms that one might find in the wild, Peter?
Well, just that they've got deadly toxins in them, and there's no going back. It's for a lot of them, it's a one-way process. People are lucky; they may survive with an organ transplant, but it's just the sheer nature of the concentration of the deadly compounds. I think one of the compounds actually stops your body from breaking down proteins, and it just causes catastrophic organ failure. Look, there's a lot of poisonous plants, so there is some dose. You have to have a certain dosage, really. But with fungi, it's really is literally Russian roulette. And because there's such a big diversity of fungi too, accurate identification is just paramount. For example, in iNaturalist, there's over 3,500 fungi species documented there at the moment. But looking at it, we've probably only really got around 120 edible species in New Zealand. So, look, it's only a real small percentage of species which are edible. And you've just got to find an edible species, focus on it, and take your time to accurately identify each mushroom as you pick it. If you get a whole lot growing together, don't assume they're all the same type. Store them all separately, and you've got to be just almost clinical about the whole process. But it's really rewarding as well, because mushrooms are incredibly healthy to eat, and they have a really really nice umami flavour profile. And of course, it's just the fun of going out foraging them. They're pretty spontaneous, and they're attractive, and they smell nice. So
would you forage for restaurants? You would collect mushrooms for restaurants, but knowing what you know.
Yeah, well, probably just the main ones like the porcini, which is pretty easy to identify. Just collecting really easy to identify fungi. There are quite a few that are problematic, so we leave those out. So it's a really focused thing.
So let's look at correctly identifying what you're harvesting. The fungi is obviously a big one, but what else do people need to be really wary of within a family where, one species is fine and the other will leave you with discomfort, to say the least? What are some of the other areas to be particularly careful of?
Well, the carrot family, for example, because that's got the edible carrot, but it's also got hemlock, which is poisonous. It's got giant hogweed, which is poisonous. So that grouping is one that had to be really careful of. The yew tree is one of our poisonous conifers. We have to be aware of that too, because we can actually use a lot of conifers for infusing flavors and vinegars and things, but the yew tree is very toxic. It is a question just of putting the science into it, going through a systematic step-by-step identification process. It does take time, and for me it has been a lifetime of just building up that knowledge incrementally. I mean, I've become an accidental botanist. I've always had a little bit of a passing interest in plants, but it really is foraging that's turned me into botany. So ornithology and fish were really my passions, but I've now sort of obviously gone through into plants and also fungi. And, my goal is to try and get up to 10,000 species recorded on iNaturalist that's a target that I want to hit. And I think if I geek out and meet with some specialists in New Zealand, I might be able to do that. That will, of course, go beyond edible species, but just looking at the biodiversity of what we have in New Zealand.
So what drives the foraging as a joy for you? Is it necessarily providing the food? Or is it, as it is for many hunters and gatherers, the locations that it takes you to and just the detailed appreciation of the environment? You sound like you also really enjoy setting yourself a target and going for it. What would you say is the joy that's made you focus on this now?
Oh, well, it's just really relaxing from a mental health point of view. You know, you've got the mindfulness aspect. It just allows you to, forget about your worries and just sort of focus on what you're doing, and just having that sort of sensory engagement is really big. And to be honest, with everything that's happening in the world at the moment, it gives a really good feeling of sort of self-reliance, of food sovereignty. Even on your news bulletin this morning, there was talk of global food distribution systems starting to break down. And, I'm getting a lot of people who are hiring me to basically go and look at their lifestyle block and point out food. If there's a food shortage or emergency, they can actually sustain themselves from foods. And some really commonplace things like broadleaf plantain produces a really nice edible grain. A lot of wild greens, dandelions, watercress, they're all really highly nutritious and good to eat. The motivation is just the diversity. To be honest, at the moment, I'm probably spending more time actually doing workshops and foraging tours rather than actual restaurant foraging. That's something I put aside for a while. I'm just slowly getting back into it at the moment.
Who comes on your tours?
A huge diversity of people, but pretty much marketing it towards local people who just want to get out, and a lot of people just want to do something different. I have shied away a little bit from the international market, that will probably develop further down the track. So, yeah, just a huge diversity of people, Catherine. It's, I do a lot of them locally here in Otatahi, Christchurch, but looking at sort of travelling around the Motu and getting up into the North Island, I was up in Northland last week on a National Wetlands Conference, and there was a fascinating experience just getting to see the Matarangi, the cultural connections up there, and just the diversity of a very different landscape. So it sort of made me aware that there's a lot of different places in New Zealand to sort of set out and explore.
It's part of it, isn't it? A bit like hunting or fishing or anything else, or bird watching, ornithology or photography, it's a reason to be somewhere we otherwise in our modern lives just wouldn't go. And the benefits are actually being out there, as well as, you say, the mindfulness, needing to focus on what you're looking at and what you're looking for.
Yep. And, it is exciting at the moment. I'm focusing on researching a critically endangered bird, the Matuku Haripo, or the Australasian bittern. And I've been interested in this bird for about 20 years now, and in the Waitaha or Canterbury region, we're down to about 30 birds left in the region. The species is at a critical point. We're close to losing it, actually, and it's very much a Tonga species. It's a icon of our wetlands. It's a really striking bird. They jump out of the rushes. They're exciting to encounter. And so I'm actually lucky to have a research contract with Environment Canterbury at the moment to summarise up all my observations over the last 8 months, and to work in with scientists on making a national management plan for that species. And I'm also a trustee on the New Zealand Bittern Conservation Trust. So that was why I was up in Northland with the Wetlands Conference. And up there, iwi were just intertwining the matarangi, the story of the bittern's flights, the eel migration routes. All these linkages started coming in, and it made me think, it's sort of a tangata, a tangata, a tangata. It's the people, it's the people, it's the people. And, I think everything's becoming really hard-edged now. We're gone into this sort of economic thing where it's all about money, it's all about commodities. There's a real dehumanisation process at the moment, which is really concerning me. And I was actually on the Treaty of Waitangi grounds last week, and local iwi were up there were really concerned too about all the rapid changes. So with all this going on, it's good just to hop in the car and, go for a walk around a wetland, or go for a walk down the beach, or hop in my wetsuit, or go fly fishing. So I've probably got a mind that needs a million and one distractions to stay sane.
But also the physical. I think anything that's primal, it's why we still love looking at an open fire. that's primal, that calms the farm, right? Calms the nervous system. And it's why the blue is good for mental health. It's why the green is good for mental health, being water, being forests, being trees. Because right at the base of our lizard brains is a sense of just solving some basic fundamental problems, security, sleep, sex. We'll talk about that another day. and provision of food and of shelter. Peter Langlands is our guest. We're talking about Foraging New Zealand, which is his latest book. It focuses primarily on the plants, but we are talking about plants, fungi, seafoods and seeds and others as well. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan on RNZ National. I hope we've done enough to tell people you need to be careful, you need to know what you're gathering and what you're eating. And we'll move on to some of the other stuff in the book now, Peter. Although I should say, interestingly, some plants that we do eat, like rhubarb, it's the old story, you can eat the stalks but not the leaves. And this is something else you need to know. Even if you found yourself the right plant, you need to know what you can eat and what you can't, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of species that are poisonous in one state but edible in another, or a lot of trees and plants. You can eat one part but not the other. Interestingly, you can actually eat the flesh from the karaka berry. It's got a nice feijoa flavour, but of course the nut, unless it's processed properly, is quite toxic. So, yeah, there's a lot of idiosyncrasies there, and you just slowly build up confidence over time with learning how to use some of the more specialised things. I think green elderberries can be harvested and put through some saline solutions to take out some of the toxins, and then made edible as basically an elderberry caper. So look, yeah, just as your skill level increases over time, you can experiment more. I mean, just go slowly with it, take your time, do your research. If you're trying a new wild food for the first time, it does pay to just try a small amount. Even some of the edible recognized, or some of the recognised edible mushrooms, will cause quite severe gastric upsets for some people, and that's just an individual reaction. So, it's a journey, and it's a good one to just be mindful of and to go slowly with, and just sort of be fully appreciative with. But being able to concisely get everything into the book has been a goal, and it's taken 4 years, and I'm really lucky to have had the assistance of Harriet Allen, who is my primary editor at Penguin Books, and she put a lot of effort and time into the book as well, to getting it all sorted. And if it wasn't for her, I don't think the book would have been completed in the time frame it has. So, you know, a big shout out to Harriet Allen. Her enthusiasm for the project was infectious. And Rachel Eady, who also was the managing editor, she really helped tie it all up right at the end when we were putting all the photos together.
What about seaweed? Which there's a lot of interest in it for lots of reasons at the moment, and in some cuisine, well, Japanese cuisine, it's, you know, prolific. Mm-hmm. What's the story with it here?
Yeah, it's real interesting, Catherine. We're a maritime nation. We've got some of the best edible seaweeds in the world, but MPI regulations in New Zealand have really held back chefs being able to use them in New Zealand, and that's been a real issue. I think it's really kept seaweed out of our culture, and we've got some amazing seaweeds here, like branching velvet weed. It gets thrown off mussel rafts during harvesting. It could be used. It's very, very popular in Europe, and used by some of the top chefs in vegan vegetarian dishes. If you put in the species scientific genus named Codium into Instagram, the hashtag, you get about 4,000 posts, and you can see the diversity of uses for the seaweed overseas. But MPI haven't been able to really manage things properly in New Zealand on a small scale where we can sustainably use resources, but because the infrastructure and this integration of science isn't there. And this is a real concern of mine at the moment, is a lot of government departments, I feel, are failing to connect with how our resources can be used, because the departments themselves are under-resourced to do it. And tragically, I think we all lose with that current scenario, and that's why I do feel quite strongly with what's happening at the moment. We really actually need to invest more in infrastructure, more in science, more in the government departments, and getting it all back together so that we can use localised management to maximise the use of our wild food resources.
How often would you get a complete meal from your foraging?
Pretty often. Typically around 60 to 70% of the ingredients will be foraged. I really enjoy a big diversity of flavours. So I do often go to specialty food shops. Pico here in Christchurch is a favourite. It's got a lot of diverse stuff. The farmers market, South City, South Christchurch farmers market, I love. So I do buy food, but I try to think about it as much as possible. And if I had to, I could live on wild foods for a whole year. It wouldn't be a problem. But I do buy probably about 30 to 40% of my food just to experience that sort of full diversity. I mean, I just bought some Mediterranean anchovies, and it would be pretty tricky for me to go out and catch anchovies here in Christchurch.
I'm so glad Pico's still going after all these decades. What legends.
Yeah, it's an institution.
It sure is. What about the link between some of what you forage and the cooking? Bring us right back to the fact it was a chef who sort of started collaborating with you so much on this. If you have a pile of bitter leaves or something else, with forage food, are you often looking at different ways of preparing it in order to get it ready?
Oh yeah, for sure. It's mind blowing what can be done. Really, the sky's the limit. But my partner Jackie, actually, she does a lot of the preparation and cooking of the foods that I get. I've become a bit lazy in the kitchen, so I get reminded of that quite a bit. So my partner Jackie Phillips at Wild Cuisine, she loves just showing on Instagram what she's doing with the wild foods and the diversity. I've had a bit of a break, actually, really, from working too closely with chefs, and there's no real reason for that, but I do look forward to getting back in touch and, working with them. I was quite lucky to also work in with Ed Werner, and when he was at Pasture, and supplying him with elderflowers, and he was doing some pretty cool stuff with elderflowers. And yeah, it is exciting actually working in with chefs, but it does require, it's quite an intense environment, and it's often very time framed and demanding. So I've actually enjoyed having a break from that sort of scene for a few years, but it's something that I'll slowly work back into, I think.
You got a few other things on the go. Thank you, Peter Langlands. The book is Foraging New Zealand. It is published by Penguin.